All right. We are live, but not live. Day two of the Steve Bannon trial. This is David Freiheit, Montreal litigator, turned YouTuber, Rumbler, Locals content creator, known as the pseudonym Viva Fry, covering this, doing exclusive daily analyses for the post-millennial. And this is day two, summary analysis, breaking it down for everyone. What happened on day two of the Steve Bannon trial? You will recall, as we left off yesterday, we were in the process of jury selection. One would have thought that this morning we would have completed with the process of jury selection and just moved straight into the trial with opening statements and first witnesses. But court, for anyone who has ever practiced law, you will know, is oftentimes a situation of hurry up and wait. Unforeseens happen all the time. Delays. And this morning, on day two of Steve Bannon's trial, was no different. Overall summary, for those of you who may not know, Steve Bannon is under trial now for contempt of Congress, two counts, one for failing to appear as a witness, the other for failing to provide documents requested in a subpoena from Congress under the pretext of that House committee that has been set up to investigate the events of January 6th. Yesterday was day one, jury selection. Today, they were supposed to complete jury selection and move on to trial. But what ended up happening this morning were what they call a motion in limine to discuss the admissibility of evidence that the prosecution wanted to admit as evidence for their case. The correspondence at issue, or the exhibits, the evidence at issue, were correspondence between the committee itself and Steve Bannon's attorneys as relates to the subpoena to testify, to produce documents. The committee issues the subpoena. Steve Bannon's counsel accepts service of the subpoena, meaning they say, okay, we will accept this subpoena and not insist that you serve it on Steve Bannon personally. Bannon's counsel then replies, look, we think we have executive privilege. We think there's issues relating to the constitution of this committee, in that it only has 9 members, whereas it shall have 13 members, as per the House Resolution 503 that saw the creation of this committee in the first place. Won't repeat too much of what I said yesterday. There's some back and forth between the committee's counsel, and Bannon's counsel, talking about the issue of executive privilege, whether or not the subpoena is valid in the first place. The prosecution wants to admit this correspondence as evidence, at which point the defense, Steve Bannon's defense, says, whoa, you can't admit these letters, this correspondence, into evidence, because last week, Judge Nichols, a Trump appointee, said Bannon cannot invoke executive privilege or attack the legitimacy of the committee itself. So to the extent that Steve Bannon has been precluded by the judge of raising certain defenses that are legal defenses, you know, subject to appeal, can't argue it or raise it before the jury. Bannon's attorneys, Schoen, S-C-H-O-E-N, is now basically saying the prosecution can't insist on admitting this correspondence as evidence because it directly speaks to the very defense that Bannon himself is precluded from raising. And it's a very interesting thing because, as far as my understanding goes, it was the prosecution that moved to preclude Bannon from being able to invoke executive privilege, professional reliance, or attacking the validity of the committee itself. It was the prosecution that petitioned the court to preclude Bannon from being able to do this. And it was Judge Nichols in his order that said, yeah, Bannon can't raise these defenses before the jury. And now you have the prosecution itself saying, okay, we know we've moved the court for this issue a while back. We got a ruling which is wildly in our favor, and now we want to admit as evidence correspondence which speaks directly to that which Bannon has been precluded from invoking as a defense by the judge. From what I have been told from the boots on the ground, one individual in particular, Joe Nierman, following some Twitter feeds of people who are covering this live from the courtroom, the judge was not too impressed with the prosecution. And the defense said, well, look, if they're going to want to admit this documentation as evidence, we need to regroup, postpone the trial for 30 days. This will now be Bannon's third time, by my count, in less than a week, asking for a postponement of the trial. I've got to tell you, you know darn well the judge is not going to grant a postponement on this third request, not just because it's the third request and he's denied the first two. They haven't impaneled the jury, but they've already gotten substantially into the jury selection process. They've whittled it down to a group of 22 to be subsequently whittled down after, you know, the strikes that each party can get to 16, and then they get down to a jury of 14, 12 jurors and two alternates. They're already well into that process. So if this judge was not amenable to postponing the trial as per Bannon's previous two requests before they even got into jury selection, there's a snowball's chance in summer that he's going to grant it now. And surprise, surprise, the judge didn't. The judge said, I might consider postponing the trial till next Monday while all of you figure this stuff out and we see how we proceed. Ultimately, what the judge did was just continue, not for the day, but until the afternoon, postpone and say, counsel, figure it out. It seems prosecution and defense figured it out. And this correspondence between the committee and Bannon's attorneys is going to make it in as evidence, which seems to open the door now for Bannon to raise executive privilege as an issue of fact. His knowledge, his understanding, or confusion on a matter of fact as relates to executive privilege, it seems to open the door for Bannon to make those arguments before the jury. And if that door was open just a crack, it seems that the prosecution might have just busted down that door altogether in their opening statements, because in their opening statements, the prosecution brought up executive privilege. The prosecution itself now opened the door to the issue of executive privilege. And to the extent that they've opened the door, Bannon presumably is going to seize on that either in cross-examination, in examination himself, if he testifies, and certainly in argumentation. So after this argument over the admissibility of these documents, this motion in limine, which is pre-trial motions, basically, after the adjournment to 1 o'clock, they come back, they've resolved this issue. The correspondence between the committee and Steve Bannon is going to make it into evidence. They then whittle down the jury to 14, 12 members of the jury and two alternates. My understanding, I'm not sure about the subsequent demographic breakdown of this jury pool, but 9 men, 5 women, and I'm not sure who were the alternates. They've got their jury. They've got their motion in limine resolved. I think it was resolved largely in favor of Bannon, strategically, in my humble opinion. And then they start with the trial, and they start at rapid pace. Apparently, opening arguments or opening statements started at about 3 o'clock today, 15 minutes each. Prosecution argues what you knew they were going to argue. Steve Bannon, above the law, thinks he doesn't have to respect congressional subpoenas because the Congress is the law. They issued the subpoenas. He said, I have executive privilege. I don't have to abide by this. We, the committee, said, no, you do not benefit from executive privilege. You must submit. And Steve Bannon, a man who defies the law, thought he was above the law, just didn't respect the power of the committee. That's their argument. And it's a relatively strong argument in that they issue a subpoena. He does not comply with the subpoena. That's it. The other defenses, did he have executive privilege? Is it a lawfully binding subpoena? Is it a valid subpoena issued by a validly formed committee? If those issues are not adjudicated before the jury, they'll be argued on appeal. But that's it. That's what prosecution comes in and says. Defense comes in and says, look, the committee knew Bannon was invoking executive privilege. We were having correspondence exchanges to work around those issues. We didn't think these deadlines were hard deadlines. We thought we were working with Congress. This is not a question of Bannon flouting the law, thumbing his nose at the authority of Congress. This is a question of Bannon, a man who wants to respect the law, wants to comply with the subpoenas, mandated an attorney, had multiple back and forths, and was trying to figure out the modalities of this. He was not above the law. He was trying to work with Congress to make sure that he respected the law, which in his mind might also have implied respecting the law as relates to executive privilege. He didn't flout the law. He didn't ignore Congress. He worked with them. We didn't think these deadlines were hard deadlines. And so when we didn't respect them, we didn't think we were in contempt, yada, yada, yada. That's it. Those were the opening arguments, opening statements from both parties after the motion in limine had been adjudicated, jury selected. What was left in the rest of the day? Not much time, but time enough to start with the first witness, which was the counsel for the committee, Kimberly Amerling, I believe is her name. She testified, I think it's for about an hour and a quarter, not particularly compelling testimony, predictable testimony, talking about House Resolution 503, talking about the formation of the committee, how it's a valid committee, what the purpose of the committee was, what the object of these subpoenas was, because as we saw yesterday and as we've discussed time and time again, the House resolution that created this committee, that set out the parameters of the investigative capabilities of this committee, we know that congressional committees have to have a valid legislative purpose. And Amerling is testifying to the effect that, you know, the valid legislative purpose of this committee is to determine what legislation might be necessary in the future on a going forward basis to ensure that these dark events of January 6th never recur. So she testified on the formation of the committee, the validity of the committee, yada, yada, yada. But from what I had been told, every time they talked about January 6th and the day of January 6th, this attorney was describing it like it was the darkest day in the history of America. Constantly invoking the loss of life, apparently repeatedly referring to loss of police officers' life in describing the day. Now, she didn't get very far into her testimony. They'll get into it more tomorrow. It's when people talk about this being a political issue, and this was one of the other aspects raised by the defense in their opening statements, arguing this is pure politics. The only reason Stephen Bannon is being charged, is being indicted on contempt of Congress, is for politics. That's the double-edged sword of this, because I think raise the argument to the jury that this is pure politics. The jury might say, yeah, this is pure politics, and that's why we're going to find Bannon guilty, even though by a strict letter of the law, he might be guilty to the extent none of his legal defenses are valid, if and if. But this lawyer talking about January 6th and invoking what she's referring to, the tragic loss of life. Look, I was featured in a, let me just pull this up. I was featured in a Newsweek article today called Right-wing YouTuber. Steve Bannon guest predicts how court hearing will play out. Look at this. Canadian right-wing legal analyst and YouTuber David Fryhead, who goes by the pseudonym Viva Fry, recently claimed that Steve Bannon's trial on charges of contempt of Congress will be wrapped up quickly because of an anti-Bannon jury selection process. And it goes on, and it's a great article. I think it's actually quite flattering, despite the name calling. But if being accurate makes me right-wing, like I have recently changed my Twitter profile to, I don't consider myself right-wing, but I do consider it a compliment to be called right-wing. This case is politics. It's pure politics, and it's politics that has been played out before the committee hearings and now is being played out in court. One aspect of the political spin to this and the politics game that is being played, when they talk about the tragic loss of life of that day, and now you have the committee lawyer testifying before the jury about the loss of police officers' life. We will recall from the first day of this event, an officer, Brian Sicknick, who the New York Times reported was killed by a group of pro-Trump supporters. I think the headline was something to the effect of, he dreamed of being a Capitol police officer and then was beaten by a mob of pro-Trump protesters. Brian Sicknick, this was touted as one of the prime examples of the horrors of that day. It was repeated time and time again during the second impeachment of Donald Trump. And the story turned out to be bunk. It turned out to be total misinformation. People were calling it out as misinformation the day of. New York Times talking about Officer Brian Sicknick getting killed. Apparently he was struck in the head with a fire extinguisher. That turned out to be false. Then he died of a stroke, which was instigated or initiated by chemical spray because allegedly he was bear maced. Ultimately, It turned out that Brian Sicknick died of natural causes of a stroke. The New York Times has yet to correct that fake news story, which a lot of media ran with to overhype the violence of that day to say it was so violent, a police officer was beaten to death by a group of pro-Trump supporters when he wasn't. There have been a number of other situations of officers having taken their own lives in the weeks following those events, which is extremely disturbing information in and of itself. That being said, the violence of that day, by all accounts, there were only two people killed, one of whom was Ashley Babbitt, and the other one was Rose Boyland. I forget if her name was Roseanne Boyland, I believe, who was allegedly trampled or assaulted and passed away. But the narrative of January 6th being one of tragic loss of life because of the violence has been weaponized to the point of these committee hearings, a second impeachment of Donald Trump, and now is being brought to the court. And I will argue that it's actual misinformation. When people say loss of life, the loss of life of that day, there were medical emergencies, as there will be when there's hundreds of thousands of people, statistically speaking. The lawyer for the campaign talking about officers having gotten killed or having lost their lives to suggest that it was as a result of the violence of the crowd, playing politics to the jury, playing smart politics to the jury because the goal of litigation is to win, except in the goal of prosecution, the goal is justice. Whether or not we're going for justice or political injustice or just political reprisals, when you have the lawyer for the committee talking about January 6th in ways that many people have often analogized it to Pearl Harbor and 9/11, you know that we have departed from accuracy for narrative. And if ensuring that things remain accurate and factually based makes someone, a right-wing YouTube commentator, I'll accept the compliment but disagree with it nonetheless. But you know that this is where the testimony is going to be going in chief. The lawyer will get cross-examined. But at the end of the day, although the prosecution is going to want to make this a trial about January 6th, cross-examination can only get so far when this is not about attacking January 6th itself. This is about an issue relating to Stephen Bannon. Did he get the congressional subpoena? Was it a valid subpoena? Did he think, as a matter of fact, that he did not have to comply with it, or that he was somewhat in compliance with it while he was in discussion with the committee as to modalities or how to respect the subpoena while purportedly respecting executive privilege? We'll see. But the day one jury selection done, carried over into day two, motion in limine to discuss the admissibility of evidence, the request of which seems to conflict with prior requests from the parties. And it's very interesting, by the way. You would think that the defense would want to have that correspondence in so that they could, in fact, bring up the issue of executive privilege. And you would think that the Crown would not want to open the door to that because Bannon has effectively been precluded from raising it. It's a bizarre turn of events, to say the least. We'll see how it pans out. But that is where it is right now. Going into day three, we're going to have more witnesses. I'm not exactly sure what the witness list is, but we're going to finish with the prosecutors, with the Crown attorney testifying tomorrow. There'll be some good cross-examination, I presume. And then we'll see where this goes. And the relevance, the importance of this trial, in as much as many people think it's a kabuki show trial, a kangaroo court, political persecution, as a pure matter of law, there's an issue here. Did someone comply with the subpoena? The fact that we have seen so few people ever indicted and prosecuted on contempt of Congress should show you that a select judicial process is a politicized judicial process, is a broken judicial process. So the fact that so few people in the history of American history have actually been indicted on contempt of Congress charges should show you or cause you to question why now, why Bannon? Why such a vigorous pursuit of an indictment against Bannon? Others of you out there are going to say this is January 6th was among the darkest days in American history. We need justice, and people cannot flout the law because they think they're above the law. That's where it's going. The importance of this trial is going to be whether or not one continues to view the prosecutorial system as one that pursues justice or one that pursues politics. Time will tell where it's going to go. My prediction is in, as noted by Newsweek. And if I turn out to be right, maybe you're right that I'm on the right. Stay tuned for a similar recap tomorrow after day three. If you want to find me on social medias, Viva Fry, YouTube, Rumble, Viva Fry on Twitter, vivabar.locals.com on Locals. And this will be on the podcast for the post-millennial. From what I understand, yesterday's podcast is doing very well on the charts. This one should do just as well, and we'll have another one tomorrow. And as long as this trial goes on, I will do an exclusive summary analysis at the end of the day. People, you know what to do. Peace out.